in deference to the fact, I know some of you are Midwesterners, we're going to branch out just a little bit, at least briefly, and talk a little bit about what I'll call the ice ages in total.
Tony?
Since that's a topic.
Tony?
She'd like to shake your hand. She's introducing herself.
Come on, Tony. Good. Let's kind of do it. No, come on, Tony.
Are you going to stand, Tom, are you going to stand up here when you talk?
No, I think we're just not taped. I don't.
Okay, well, I've got it on.
Okay, all right.
You don't have to hold this. Just tell me where you're going to be when you're
all here.
That'll be fine.
The last ice ages, as we generally call it, started, to use round numbers, probably about 2 million years ago. And during that time, there were a number of advances and retreats of the glaciers, and there were times when, in between the glacial cycles, the climate, the temperature, the extent of the ice was probably less than it is now. And so we see a rather major change. We still don't really know why this happened. It's fairly easy sometimes to explain one glaciation in a sense of one cycle, but to talk about multiple cycles has been very complicated because it has to be something astronomical and repetitive if it's astronomical, and so far that's kind of eluded everybody. So it's one of these things that the facts remain it happened, but why it happened is still a little bit hard to understand. The last major cycle started around 100,000 years ago and ended, at least in this country, ended probably about 10,000 years ago. The ice retreated back into Canada, and it took somewhat longer for Canada to get ice-free than we see here. But that's the general pattern. So let me start by talking a little bit about
Put your lights on?
Yes, if you would, please.
Sure.
This is the pattern of glaciers, the large, what we call ice sheets, that occurred during, we'll look at the last ice sheet. The glaciations were synchronous in Europe and also in the U.S. and North America. The southern hemisphere was glaciated to some extent, but the continents down there, for the most part, with the exception of Antarctica, are pretty much far enough away from the polar areas that they didn't receive much glaciation. Right now, of course, Greenland is still covered to a large degree by an ice sheet, but most of the rest of it has disappeared. There are some smaller ones on Baffin Island and a few places like that. What we actually see around the North Pole is simply frozen sea ice. It's not a glacier as such. To be a glacier, the ice has to actually be in motion or have been in motion. So it means accumulating ice thick enough so that it finally becomes mobile. In our area, there were two major ice sheets, the Laurentide ice sheet that you see here. And in the mid-continent, where there really are no barriers or were no barriers, the ice migrated to the south and went well into the middle of the U.S. And actually, the glacial cycles have been given names that correspond to where the furthest extent of the deposits. So we find things like Nebraska and Kansas. The last major glaciation is referred to as the Wisconsin. Out in our part of the country, in the west, the mountains, of course, were heavily glaciated. But the ice sheet also came down into the northern part of a little bit of Montana and Idaho and into Washington. This is called the Cordilleran ice sheet because it was largely involved with some of the mountains in the west. And because of the mountains, the ice sheet just simply didn't penetrate nearly as far. So here in Washington, we see the effects of the ice sheet coming down the vicinity of Spokane over here. A large ice lobe that came down the Okanagan River and into the upper plateau area. And the end of this one is just about almost due east of us here. And then a very large one that came down the Puget Sound area and went a little ways past Olympia. The Cascades and the Olympics made a fairly nice channel pattern or channel arrangement for the so-called Puget Lobe to migrate southward, so it went considerably further than the ones that were off to the east. And then, of course, the Cascades in here were extensively glaciated, but not particularly by the ice sheet. It appears as though one of the major lobes of the ice sheet did go down Lake Chelan, so it was kind of a combination of what we look at as being the mountain glaciers and also the major ice sheets. But to give you some idea of scale, the Puget Lobe in Seattle is looked at as being having been probably about 3,000 feet thick. And by the time one got up to the border, to the Canadian border, probably about twice that. So these are really huge masses of ice. And those of you that might live in the Midwest, chances are certainly if you live north of the, anywhere north of this ice border, while you're living on in and around glacial deposits, certainly, and there are any number of glacial moraine parks and of course kettle lakes and all kinds of things that are attributed to the glacier, all kinds of erratics. It was interesting to me the first time I went back into the Midwest to see how many folks had pet rocks long before pet rocks were really popular by putting one out in their front yard. We're going to deal with glaciers that are what we call mountain glaciers or alpine glaciers. Almost all the terminology that we use comes out of the Alps because this is the area where the mountain glaciers were first studied. And so most of the terminology is spin off from either French or German. If you're a crossword puzzle person, you'll perhaps get exposed to a number of things that end up in crossword puzzles. The glaciers very much remodel the landscape. They start out initially by following the standard stream patterns, and probably in order for a mass of ice and snow to really become a glacier, it would have to exceed certainly 100 feet in thickness, and in most cases probably several hundred feet before it would become mobile enough to actually start moving. Then it simply flows either by sliding, and it does this sometimes, or sometimes by internal recrystallization changes that occur within the ice. So from the time the snow falls in the upper part of the mountains until the glacier gets down to where it finally disappears, there's a very dramatic change from the snow crystals that show up in the early part of the glacier to big massive chunks of crystalline ice that show up down at the bottom end. Some of the glacial topography, the high-pointed mountains that we typically see are called horns. It doesn't show up here, but a horn, the Matterhorn in the Alps is kind of the classic horn, but that's pretty standard. We'll see a number of those as we go along. In fact, there are some right here. Sharp little ridges that divide glacial valleys or run along the crest of some of the alpine areas are called arêtes. You need a nice five-letter word for a mountain ridge, why this fits almost every time. The basin where the alpine glaciers start, the glaciers will cut their way back into the mountains, and they make a rather distinct amphitheater kind of basin that's called a cirque. If there's a lake in the bottom of the cirque, and there often is, that lake is referred to as a tarn, T-A-R-N. And again, if you need a four-letter word for a mountain lake, why that works almost without exception. Glaciers carve very much in proportion to size. The bigger the glacier, the more rapidly it can carve a valley. And a glacier is like a huge rasp or a file. When it goes down the valley, it picks up rocks and debris, and it uses those just like it was a giant piece of sandpaper going down the valley. So it tends to scour out and straighten out the valleys, smooth the sides. The large glaciers erode much more rapidly than small ones, just like a big rasp is going to cut something faster than a little file. So oftentimes, where there are small glaciers that come into a large glacial valley, they do so fairly well up on the valley side, because the tributary glaciers just simply haven't been able to keep pace with the erosion of the big glacier that's running down the trunk system. And where those valleys come in, we refer to them as hanging valleys, because the opening of the valley, in essence, sits right up above the glacier. Now, a glacier migrates down the valley. The accumulation area up here is the cirque, and as the glacier migrates down the valley, it may encounter irregularities which will cause it to crack and break and fracture and make what we call crevasses. But the glacier will advance down the valley until it finally reaches a point where the melting is more than the advancing can accommodate, and at that point the glacier tends to stop. So the glacier is constantly in motion internally, even though, let's say, the end of it might just simply sit here and not move one way or the other at all. In that sense, the glacier is kind of like a conveyor belt. The material that it's hauling along will get dumped off the end of the glacier if it does stop long enough to allow that to happen. From here on up, there's a little thing called the fern line. The fern line marks the limit of last year's snow. Obviously, to be a glacier, there has to be more snow that's going to fall up here in the accumulation area than is going to melt down in the lower part of the glacier. So the glacier typically will move on beyond the fern line, but usually about September, early October, somewhere in there, we can go up and look at the glacier and pick out the fern line, because we can see where last year's snow is and where the open ice is still on down below the end of the glacier. This is South Cascade Glacier, which is kind of north and west of us here. This was taken in September, and here's the nice fern line. It isn't a terribly sharp line, except in a few places because of irregularities in the glacier, but this is all last year's snowfall, the lighter color. This is all essentially bare ice. Obviously, there are little patches of snow below the fern line because of avalanche accumulations or little sheltered spots that will carry snow from year to year, but that's a pretty typical pattern. South Cascade Glacier is like almost all the glaciers in, certainly in North and Well, world over, really. It's much smaller now than it was at some time. You can kind of pick out a line up here that would be probably right in here that marks the upper limit of where the glacier was sometime in the past, probably during the last ice age. And in fact, the glacier that's there now may be even younger than that, but that's pretty common. Here's another small valley glacier. Here's the accumulation basin in here, and the glacier has moved out, and the end of it is right here. But again, you can see by looking at the line along the edge of the valley that it's certainly been very much bigger in the past than it is now. So this is the cirque basin. Back in here. Here we're looking at some of the North Cascades. This is Glacier Peak, which is almost due west of us here. So I don't know, we're back over just beyond this peak here. This is Boston Glacier, which is one of the biggest glaciers in the North Cascades. Interestingly enough, Washington has, at the present time, about three-quarters of all the glaciers in the lower U.S. We don't compete with Alaska at all, but in terms of the glaciers that are in the continental U.S., about three-fourths of them are in the state of Washington. So this is a pretty typical horn. The sharp ridge you see here is an arete. Another one coming out here in the foreground. Virtually everything that you see along the skyline consists of horns and aretes. The North Cascades are referred to as the Alps of Washington, and that's really a pretty typical term. I don't know, the fern line isn't very sharp here. This was taken in midsummer, but it would probably end up in here someplace. The aretes vary quite a bit depending on what the bedrock is like. Most of the North Cascades are made up of pretty hard, durable rock, much like you see around here, so the geology stands up pretty well. If it's a little bit fractured and broken, then the aretes tend to be kind of sawtooth like this. If the rock is a little more substantial and durable, then it may make a fairly even sharp-edged ridge like this one, so the arets do vary somewhat. Here's again a fairly typical alpine feature, no really distinctive horn. This is the Cirque Basin. And one of the neat things about looking at glacial features is that you can walk up and look at a mountain almost anywhere and tell fairly quickly whether or not it's been glaciated. The features are very distinctive. The cirques and the arêtes and things like this are really quite easy to pick out typically. But there is a very sharp, jagged arête across the backside. Here we're looking off toward Mount Baker. And again, you see a very sharp arête going along here and some of the bigger glaciers going off to the side. Some very large glaciers. The North Cascades are a really incredible area, and unfortunately, most people, if they get to the North Cascades Park at all, see very little of it because there is no access unless you're on foot. You drive through and you look up at the mountains and think, gee, they look pretty nice. So you almost have to get up in an airplane or something to get the full scope of what the area looks like. Here we're looking at Dumbbell. And Dumbbell really is this is a Bonanza. Bonanza is a horn. This is one of the glaciers that hang over Holden Lake. This is Mary Green Glacier. There's another small glacier that sits in here, that's Isella. Really nice arête that runs down this way. Bonanza is the highest non-volcanic peak in the Cascades. So it carries several pretty nice glaciers. Another view of some of the alpine country in the North Cascades, just absolutely incredible. Holden Lake. Holden Lake is a tarn, one of the really pretty ones. The Mary Green Glacier is still up here on the upper edge of it, but this is a beautiful cirque basin. And at one time was occupied by a glacier. The glaciers tend to kind of flow down and out, and so very commonly they'll scour out the bottom of the cirque basin. And once the glacier melts, that natural basin tends to fill with water. There are a lot of them that are filled up with sediment and now are old marshy or boggy or grasslands or whatever. But Holden Lake is a very striking, very classic tarn. Here we're looking at Dumbbell, and you can see the nice cirque basin here. A little bit of a one back up in here. The mountain itself really is a nice horn, so pretty typical glacial pattern. The glaciers also tend to carve valleys that are remarkably U-shaped. The U is a form that offers the least resistance to flow. If somebody's going to make a nice flume or anything like this, the U shape is the ideal shape because it has the least contact with what's flowing through it. This happens to be a valley that's tributary to the Skagit River, a little bit north of us here. But you can see the very classic U form. And again, that varies considerably depending on what kind of rock material is present in the valley, how big the glacier was, what the glacier was carrying. Some areas of the U's are very broad and flat and open. Sometimes they're even more sharp than this, but that's a pretty typical form. I would guess maybe in here the glacier was probably up to, certainly in this level perhaps, when it was active. We find valleys that we know have been glaciated by the presence of scour marks and things like that, but sometimes the streams that occupy the valley will tend to remodel them. The streams make a valley that's V-shaped. And so oftentimes a stream will reoccupy the valley when the glaciers are gone and reshape it back into a V-form, so they don't always retain their nice U shape. This will look familiar to some of you, I'm sure. We're looking from the Holden Lake trail back down to the village. This is the mine tailings and the upper mine area in here. This was obviously taken a few years ago before the tailings were covered over with gravels. But this is a typical, beautiful U-shaped valley when you get up and get a chance to actually take a look down the valley. Or look the other way from up on the tailings. You don't have to walk as far as Holden Lake. And this is the shape looking back up. Here's Bonanza Peak again and North Star. The white spot here is the falls coming out of Heart Lake. This is also a stepped valley. When one goes back up the valley, Lyman Lake and Lyman Glacier sit up around the corner and up in a higher basin. And right behind Heart Lake is a very deep, steep, rocky face. And the glacier then came over that step down into the Heart Lake Basin, advanced out here. There's another step right here that barricades the lower end of Heart Lake, and the water spilled over that step and then comes on down the valley. So oftentimes the valleys are very distinctly stepped. The glacier seems to go kind of in little jumps and spurts. So not all U-shaped valleys are step valleys, but certainly some of them are. This is in the Stewart Range, which is just north of Ellensburg. And again, the Stewarts, I don't know if you've ever driven through the Kittitas Valley along I-90 and looked up to the north. You look into the front side of the Stewarts, but here's a beautiful classic horn with some small cirque basins and then a whole series of steps that go down the valley here and ultimately end up at Leavenworth with a whole complex series of lakes going down. So we're looking kind of, well, pretty much to the west across the Cascades. And even here, they're obviously pretty classic glacial forms. So, again, in our valley, the two steps are primarily in the Lyman Lake Basin, Heart Lake Basin. There's a rocky barrier right here that the Holden Creek, Railroad Creek has cut through and steps down into the valley, but those are the only steps in the upper part of the basin. It's a little surprising, I guess, that Railroad Creek hasn't modified the valley a little bit more. Right behind us is the Copper Basin area. This is probably one of the prettiest hanging valleys you'd ever want to see, aside from going to Yosemite or someplace like that where the textbooks always use one of the Yosemite valleys where the glacier carved the valley into a very deep bedrock form and then the waterfalls spill out and go down 1,500 feet or so. But this is a very typical Hanging Valley. It doesn't have a big classic waterfall, but it certainly Copper Creek comes out with a series of small waterfalls and cascades, and that's quite typical of our more local Hanging Valleys. But again, you see the beautiful U-shape here of the valley where the glacier came out and joined the one that was coming down the Railroad Creek Valley. Here's the entrance to the Holden Basin again. Beautiful Hanging Valley. So this tells us certainly that the glacier, when it came through this area, had to be at least as high as the lip of the Holden, the entrance into the Holden Valley. So it had to be up at least this deep, and beyond that it's a little hard to say, but this certainly was the home to a very large mountain glacier. The end of Railroad Creek is also a hanging valley, although it's much more difficult to demonstrate or photograph. You can see a little bit of that pattern here, but maybe it's more demonstrated by the fact that when you got off the boat and got on the bus, the first 2 miles consisted of getting yourself up about 1,000 feet to almost 2,000 feet very quickly, and then the everything flattens out and you get a nice fairly long straight ride up to the village. So that's the lip of the Hanging Valley. The creek in the lower end has made a very deep channel, obviously, as if you've ridden on the outside of the bus as you came up and looked down into that valley where the creek is before it hits the lake. It certainly made a major change there, but once it gets up and once you get up on higher into the valley, then the creek very much runs along the floor of the current valley. So we're also in a Hanging Valley. Lake Chelan is what we call a finger lake. Finger lakes are long, narrow lakes that have occupied glacial valleys because either some glacial deposits have dammed the valley, or sometimes a hard bedrock layer will dam the valley. These are not like the so-called Paternoster lakes that we see in a steppe valley. If you've done any hiking at all in the mountains and you come to places where somebody says, well, these are chain lakes, chances are that those are probably Paternoster lakes, as we call them, where the lakes occupy a series of steps. But Lake Chelan really is the ultimate finger lake. The classic finger lakes, where the name really came from, are the lakes in, I call them the Hiawatha Lakes in upper New York State, where you have Cayuga and Onondaga and so on. A whole series of lakes that have a really long, parallel, skinny kind of appearance. And so early on, they got the name Finger Lakes. Well, Lake Chelan is the ultimate, penultimate, perhaps, Finger Lake. It's the only one I know of that's 50 miles long and certainly 1,500 feet deep. A little bit further south of us, here's Lake Chelan running up this way. South of us, there are three very prominent Finger Lakes also. If you've ever driven across the Cascades on the Snoqualmie Pass Highway or I-90, you go right by Lake Ketchelis, which is one of the prominent Finger Lakes. Lake Cochise, another one. Lake Cleellum, a third one in here. These are all modified a little bit by dams now. Well, so is Lake Chelan as far as that goes. But nevertheless, those are very classic Finger Lakes. Lake Wenatchee up here is another. So we have several Finger Lakes. If you go across the northern Olympics, Crescent Lake, Lake Crescent is a Finger Lake. Let me go back here just a second. When the Big Ice Sheet moved into the area, pretty much to the east of us here, came down the Okanagan Valley, came up onto the northern part of the Columbia Plateau, and ran across about like this. So The end of the glacier at one side is about where Dry Falls is, if you're familiar with that. The other end is probably just a little bit below Lake Chelan. But in the process, the big ice sheet also occupied the valley of the Columbia. And in the process of doing that, it diverted the Columbia. And the Columbia then carved itself a new channelway that we now refer to as Grand Coulee. It's more complicated than this, so I'm kind of oversimplifying. But nevertheless, Grand Coulee fundamentally owes its existence to having been the re-channeled Columbia River. So it also occupied this part of the valley and blockaded any water that was coming out of the Lake Chelan area. And the result was that the overflow, the meltwater, spilled over this little point right here and back into the Columbia River channel just a little bit to the south. And in the process, it began to carve a pretty deep channel. The glacier apparently pushed into the valley a little bit further and blockaded this channel way, and it then began to carve another one that became a second channel way for the water to get out of the Lake Chelan area and back into the Columbia River drainage. So there are two fairly prominent channels that go from the south end of Lake Chelan across and into the Columbia River here. One is Knapp Coulee that the main highway follows if you come up the west side of the Columbia into Chelan. The other is Navarre Coulee that most of you will probably go out of when you leave here, since it's the first one that shows up, and that's also an old channelway. This is Knapp Coulee. And again, it's one of these things, thousands of people a year go through this and have no idea why it's there or even what it is. It's just another valley. But Knapp Coulee and the Navarre Coulee are both old drainways or channelways for the water to get out of Lake Chelan. This is one of the valleys tributary to Lake Chelan, really nice hanging valley. On the other hand, if you look at this valley straight on, the stream that comes out of here now has made a very nice deep channel, and it doesn't look like a hanging valley at all, and if you don't pick up on the fact that there are some nice shoulders here to tell you that there is a valley form other than the V-shape that's there now. Down, pretty much right across from Fields Point, where I assume most of you will land, or certainly you'll go by anyway, these are terraces formed by the melting glacier. As the glacier gradually melted, the meltwater would pile up against the side of the glacier, and the material would be washed off the sides, and it would accumulate along the margin of the glacier and make these very nice distinctive terraces. So you have to accept the fact the glacier was certainly this high or this deep, and probably higher than that, because there are glacial scar marks and things a little bit further up on the side of the valley. That gives you some kind of minimum idea. And of course, the lake itself is 1,500 feet deep, or very nearly so in some areas. So we're talking about a glacier that was probably at least 2,000 feet thick. This is, again, one of the Finger Lakes in the Cascades. This is Lake Cochise. Very nice, long, narrow valley, and a nice lake occupying the glacial valley. When the glacier moves along, it carries a lot of debris, and a lot of that stuff ends up being ground and pulverized against each other, and the result is what we call rock flour. Now, this is not like soil or anything, it's ground up rock material, and so the streams that run away from the glacier will carry the rock flour, and the rock flour gives the stream a very distinctly milky appearance. So you travel around the western U.S. almost anywhere, you're going to find Milk Creek or White River or names like this that reflect the fact that the stream is carrying rock flour. When it gets a little bit further downstream, the rock flour becomes more disseminated in the water and dispersed, and it tends to scatter the light that hits the water surface, and it gives the water then a very distinctly green tinge, kind of a funny green. The water is still somewhat murky looking, but still takes on this funny, odd green color. So we have things like Green River, and if you go to Diablo Lake up in the North Cascades, or Alder Lake, or any number of places around, where you'll find lakes that often have this this kind of appearance. So the further downstream, Heart Lake looks that way. The stream coming into Heart Lake is very distinctly greenish and murky looking, so a pretty standard pattern. The glaciers also tend to build moraine deposits. The glacier is like a dump truck, I guess. And so oftentimes along the sides of the glacier, it shows up really better here. The glacier will tend to pile up a stack of debris in the form of what we call moraines. Now, this is one of the glaciers coming out of the Columbia Ice Field in Canada. But obviously at one time in the not too distant past, the glacier was certainly up to this level and has melted back quite a bit from what it is now. So they build a very distinct moraine form. Look around the village. This happens to be Snoqualmie Pass, but there are a number of places in the village where you see deposits like this. This is glacial till. And as I say, the glacier is like a dump truck. It hauls stuff along and then dumps it someplace. And so we end up with things that are totally unsorted, unstratified. There's no layering. It's just classic dumped material. It may have everything from great big rocks to clay and silt and fine material. If you're from the Midwest, why, you probably know any number of places where rocks are sitting around, and we call those erratics. Most of those are there courtesy of Canada. The glacier is a great hauler of material, and some of the erratics, when you get over into the Columbia Plateau to the east of us here, there are erratics that are, well, probably pretty close to as big as this room, that have been hauled in and dropped off by the glacier. But this is a pretty typical moraine pattern. Live on the west side of the mountains. Most of the till is quite a bit finer. The glacier that got into the Puget Sound, there are certainly some big erratics and some real dandies here and there. Oftentimes you'll see them along the freeway. Great places for graffiti and so forth, but. Nevertheless, they do show up periodically. This is Mount Rainier, and just as a kind of comment on the status of glaciers, Mount Rainier, in a sense, is like a marshmallow sundae, I guess. The ice and snow accumulate for the most part up on the top, and then it runs off in different directions from that point. And this is the Emmons Glacier, which comes off pretty much off the east side. Now, this was taken in 1970. And you can see the edge of the glacier here. Prior to this, actually, probably 4 or 5 years before this, this was very, the edge of it was very indiscernible. There was no obvious edge to the glacier. And starting in the latter 60s, the glacier began to readvance, to move forward a little bit again. So here was 1970. This was taken in the late 70s. And now the end of the glacier is very large. It's a very steep front. And it's moved down from here to about here in terms of moving down the valley. So it has moved quite a distance over a period of about 8 years. And then this was taken 2 years ago. And now the end of the glacier has begun to soften and melt, and the edge is a little bit difficult to even pick out, except here comes the meltwater stream out. So the glaciers have gone through some very distinct cycles in terms of of their migration. Most of the glaciers in recent times have simply retreated. Now the pattern is that sometimes individual glaciers will go through different cycles, apparently because of accumulation. But a glacier doesn't respond to a one-year change. The glaciers, even though this year was a huge snowfall year in the Cascades, it's not going to make the glacier particularly any bigger. If that happens several years in a row, then that's likely to happen. By the same token, they don't disappear in a year. If it happens to be a low snowfall, warm year, it may cause them to melt a little more or retreat a little more, but it usually takes several years before the glaciers begin to respond to whatever the cycle happens to be. So now you're all experts on glaciers. Any question? Anything that?
Could you say more about what causes the tarns to form? I mean, my image of a glacier moving down a mountain is that it would be, you know, more just scouring out further and further down. So what consistently causes the depressions?
The glacier in the Cirque Basin of a glacier, the snow and ice accumulate, and of course accumulate layer by layer by layer. So every year there's more accumulation, more piling. Gradually there's a transformation then from the snow to what we call fern, which is granular snow. It's really a density change. Gradually enough, snow then will accumulate to be compressed to the form of ice. So we go from snow to fern to ice. That process probably takes, well, in our alpine glaciers, it might take 10 or 12 years before that complete transformation. But in the process, once the snow is accumulated to a deep enough level, then it will tend to begin to migrate down the slope with a kind of plastic flow, either sliding or by internal recrystallization. But the general process is for it to go down and out. Mm-hmm. And that process tends to scour out the bottom of its basin. It's always enlarging the cirque by freeze and thaw and scouring and so forth. But gradually, if it occupies a cirque long enough, some of the cirques like we see up here in Old Copper Peak and Dumbbell and those, the glaciers were never in that basin long enough to make a true basin in the floor. So the cirque is there, but it doesn't have a real basin. Consequently, it doesn't have a tarn.
The glacier that's up above Holden over the past couple of decades, is it moving down toward the lake or is it receding?
Well, it's been hard to tell. I've only been around for about 15 years and I can't see any particular change. Some of those kind of things are really awfully subtle if you look at them from a distance. And the vantage point from here isn't all that great. You can only see a portion of it anyway. But it looks like it's pretty stable, but it could well be still retreating a little bit. Which it does kind of by melting along the edge, and it's surely nothing dramatic, but most of them are still retreating a little.
When the glacier goes over the hill, how does that happen, and how does, you know, it seems to me it would go so far and then develop some sort of crack and fall.
At the edge of a cirque?
Right, the step.
Well, yeah, it simply slides over the basin. It goes down, and you'll have a whole series of crevasses, and it makes what we look at as an ice fall. Oftentimes, you'll see glaciers that do come out of a step system, and it'll be a rather spectacular big jumble of ice and fragments and And it kind of disintegrates, and once it gets to the bottom of the ice fall, it all kind of melds back together, and off down the valley it goes. And some of the Alaskan glaciers show this in a real spectacular form, where the ice, the top of the ice, the upper 70 to 100 feet is really quite brittle. And that's what causes the crevasses. The crevasses are only about that deep. They don't go to the bottom of the glacier. You go out and fall on a crevasse, you're only going to fall 70 or 100 feet. You're not going to fall through down and land on the ice or the rocks. That's any consolation. anything that stresses the glacier then is going to cause crevasses to form in the top if the glacier's moving along without running into any kind of obstacles or anything, then the surface will tend to be pretty smooth and even. So, yeah, they do literally come apart if they go over some of those steep areas. I'm sure where the glacier came out of Lyman and over that step down into Heart Lake, it was probably a pretty major ice fall and then kind of leveled out.
It just melts back together.
Yeah.
Are there any means available to date the ice that's down at the edge? Are there techniques available to?
Oh yeah, it's possible to get dates out of the ice because as the ice accumulates, every year's snowfall will leave a distinct pattern, a distinct mark. You'll have a little bit of layer of dust and things like this that accumulate on the surface before the next year's snowfall. So if one takes ice cores or if there are chances to see into the glacier, sometimes in the big crevasses, we can see the different layers. So,
like honey rings on trees.
So yeah, they're dateable. The big ice sheets in Greenland and Antarctica have been dated to some degree. Greenland, I think, has been dated back about 200,000 years, something like that.
In the Canadian Rockies, you'll see tar, I think they're tarns that are very different color. Like there's an emerald light that's really green and the marine light is very blue. What are the...
Well, it's just that it's a different distribution of the rock flower. It could have something to do, I suppose, with the kind of rock that happened to be in the source. But yeah, some of the lakes along the Canadian Ice Fields Highway are really spectacular in terms of colors and variations of colors.
Are any of the lower 48, in particular the Washington glaciers, being monitored the way
South Cascade has a monitoring system
with respect to the mobile warning
a couple of the glaciers in the Olympics also have ongoing monitoring. So, yeah, they are being to some degree, and I'm sure the ones on Mount Rainier, for example, in the park are looked at to some degree. And most of them are basically retreating a little bit. Emmons is certainly the most obvious exception that I've seen. But the others, for the most part, are still kind of gradually retreating. There's nothing I'm aware of that indicates any kind of dramatic warming system. It'd be hard to tell somebody who lived here last winter that global warming is
hard to know.
A real problem.
Does the density of the rock have anything to do with the speed of the glacier?
Well, of course, once the glacier gets the valley straightened out somewhat, it has the ability to move a little faster. But again, there are a lot of variables. What the inclination of the valley is one factor, because it's going to go faster down a steep ramp than a flat one. How big the glacier is another factor. So there are various things. There's really no such thing as an average rate of flow, but most glaciers probably only move maybe a few inches to maybe at most a foot or two a day. They're not in any foot race. And there are some exceptions. There are glaciers that are gone through what we call surges that may move tens of feet a day, but they are really exceptional.
Is there any specific mathematical curve for the path of least resistance for it?
Well, no. That's why I say the curve form or the curve bottom is the one of the parabolic. Yeah. Most of the time, what you do is you take a chain or something like this and you hold it up, and as you move it, you change the parabolic shape, and that's kind of the way the glacial valleys are. Under some circumstances, they're kind of wide and flat, and others that are kind of steep and narrow, so there are a lot of variables. But again, it depends on the kind of rock and what the glacier is carrying and how big the glacier was, and so a lot of factors.